Welcome to The Art Career, a space breaking barriers by letting you sit in on candid, straightforward conversations with leading art professionals in visual arts, writing, music, theater, and film. I'm your host, Emily McElreath, and I invite you to join me for inspirational conversations with icons of our generation. We dive deep into topics like self-development, career trajectories, mental health, social justice, and the artists that have changed our lives. With each episode, our mission is to empower you, expanding your journey through the arts. Join us for new episodes every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. The Art Career is thrilled to announce its partnership with Glimpse. Glimpse Guides are a collection of luxury guidebooks with an outstanding social mission we are proud to support. Featuring the best of hotels, restaurants, activities, and itineraries for each featured city, Glimpse Guides also include recommendations and travel tips by a curated selection of tastemakers. The most exciting part of Glimpse Guides is 100% of their profits go to Give a Glimpse, which provides funding for educational travel scholarships for underserved students. What is better than that? Glimpse believe that travel is the most important form of education, and it is their mission to send as many deserving students abroad as possible. Glimpse also offers luxury trip design services with VIP perks like early check-in, room upgrades, restaurant and spa credits, welcome gifts, and more. Glimpse has quickly become our one and only travel planner. Go check them out at glimpseguides.com and tell founder Jordan Rhodes that the Art Career Podcast sent you. Born in Manchester, UK, Jane South worked in experimental theater before moving to the United States in 1989. Solo exhibitions include Halfway Off 2023 and Switchback 2020 at Spencer Brownstone Gallery, Floor Ceiling 2013 at the Aldrich Contemporary Art Museum in Connecticut, and Box in 2011 at the Knoxville Museum of Art. South's work has been reviewed in the Brooklyn Rail, the New York Times, the LA Times, Art Forum, Art in America, Sculpture Magazine, New York Magazine, Frieze, Art News, and The New Yorker. She is represented by Spencer Brownstone Gallery in New York. Awards include the Guggenheim Fellowship, Brown RISD Mellon Foundation Fellowship, Joan Mitchell Foundation Painters and Sculptors Grant, the Pollock Krasner Foundation, and New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship. In 2018, South was elected to the National Academy of Design. She is currently chair of fine arts at Pratt Institute in New York. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Emily. Welcome.
Thank you so much. So I walked in here about 10 minutes ago, and this is just such a marvelous loft space you have. We're looking at the Brooklyn Bridge right now, so maybe it's safe to say that you have one of the best views in the world, possibly.
I think I might agree with you there. I am incredibly lucky, and it really has all been extremely serendipitous. I've been here in Dumbo for 20 years, and I moved into the space that we're in now as the roommate of somebody. And at that point, it was, as is typical in the life of the artist, there were a bunch of people living in this building. It was a commercial building. Old school landlord lived on the top floor. Everything was on the DL, and it was a wreck of a place. You would plug something in and sparks would fly.
Yeah. It was, we're lucky you're alive still.
We were living the life. And then roommate moved out. I was earning a bit more money. I could take the whole place on. This is also my studio. And then, miraculously, for New York City, really, where you always think that real estate is ruthless, the New York, I suppose it's New York State or New York City, brought in something called the loft law. And so, in a nutshell, if you were an artist living in one of these kinds of situations and you met certain conditions, then they gave you this status, which meant the owner of the building had to bring the building up to code, and then the building was transitioned to residential, the benefit for the owner being they could rent any unoccupied spaces at market, et cetera, et cetera. So,
which doesn't affect you unless it's, I mean, I guess if, they put a diner downstairs. I don't know, but who cares? Right. That was kind of my point before, you know, if you're getting this space. Yeah, it makes me really happy that the city did that. I didn't know about it until just now.
Yeah, and big shout out to all of the artists who also worked very, very hard to push this and push it and push it. A couple of those people are good friends of mine. Lee Borison is one. Eve Sussman and Simon Lee also, who were all in that building on 475 Kent. They were very, very active in really getting this, not only getting this through, but getting it through with certain kind of details that it's too much to go into. So it wasn't just the city decided and the city, it was advocacy.
I wonder what the percentage of loft living artists it actually benefited, or if it was, you know, did you get lucky, or was it, and we can move away from real estate in a second, but this is truly interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think one of the good things for us is that this is a small building. So 5 units, which is the language the loft law uses. Whereas there are, obviously, we know, humongous lofts, warehouse buildings out there. And one of the criteria, for obvious reasons, is that there has to be compatible use. So if in that enormous building there is some form of industry that makes living conditions dangerous, then maybe you don't get the coverage. And of course, that's where I'm sure there are all kinds of shenanigans and all kinds of stories of property owners doing dodgy things, et cetera, et cetera. So I certainly know people who did apply and did not get status and had to move. But I think it has helped quite a few people for sure. Yeah.
So, Jane, you and I met...
I remember you emailed.
What was it?
Well, and this is just a great example of people who are proactive. You emailed out of the blue, and you emailed me as chair of Pratt
You had
Fine
just
Arts.
Become chair of Pratt MFA.
No, all of the...
All of it.
Yeah, yeah, BFA
I
and
apologize.
MFA.
I apologize. That's right, that's right. Yeah. I knew that. Okay.
2017, and you emailed expressing interest in finding out what our grads were up to, and I said, I'll take you around, I'll give you a tour. And we did that, and that was really the beginning of our
relationship.
Yeah,
yeah. And you were so generous to do that at the time. I was genuinely interested and now have been involved in the school. This is our second year Pratt Forward.
Yes. Well, so the Pratt Forward story.
Yeah. Okay. So rewind. Jane is, we will get to this. Jane has her studio practice. Jane is chair of Pratt Fine Arts.
Yep.
Jane is also co-founder with Micheline Thomas, our good friend, of a new program called Pratt Forward.
Correct. And Pratt Forward really came about because Micheline is an alum of our BFA. And I reached out to her when I first started at Pratt. We had breakfast. And my question for her was, would you be interested in engaging with Pratt? And if so, what would be interesting to you? I think that all artists who are doing amazing things in their lives and with their work are wary when they're alma mater reaches out, because I think usually it's, would you like to write us a big check?
Yeah.
Or can we use you in a photo op?
Yeah, yeah.
So fortunately, Micheline was generous enough to meet with me. And we began a conversation. And she did mention at that first meeting that she was very, very interested in doing something that would really empower artists, and that was really about what I suppose we loosely call professional practices. So that's where we started and had a few meetings, ultimately came up with the idea of doing this for alumni. And part of the reason for that was scale, because we have a big MFA program. Mm-hmm. We have up to 40 students a year. And to be honest, if something isn't in the curriculum, then there's a question about how it's resourced, how it is sustained. And I think because the conversation that we had been having was so much about intimacy. I mean intimacy in terms of people being real with each other and sharing specific examples of pitfalls, etc. So not, although we do cover nuts and bolts, you can Google sample artist contract. You can Google S Corp versus LLC versus C Corp. The wonderful thing about technology in that regard is there are so many resources
out
there.
So many resources.
But because the art, well, one of the art worlds, because there are many art worlds, but because the marketplace is unregulated and the power has long been really in the hands of those who provide the platforms for, a lot of it is very opaque. And so what's really of value to artists that are making their way, and also thinking through who their audience is, who they want to engage with, what the right context is.
His professional practices.
Well, and develop maybe their own ideas of how to create opportunities and platforms. That's a conversation. And that's somebody like Micheline, like Derek Adams on the artist side, or like Jasmine Wahi on the side of the individual who has started a new nonprofit, which is artist-centered, their stories and what they've learned about really what's behind some of the curtains is extremely illuminating. And you can't really scale that, partly because a lot of things now get streamed. And some people, you may not want to tell that particular story to the entire universe.
Sure.
So I think this is where...
That's a good point.
Yeah. And I think this is also in a way how... It's tricky because it's also in a way how certain things continue because of the nuance, the compromise, there's a lot going on in that space. So, and I also think this is why people talk about mentorship. So I think we were trying to think about how can we share this? And if we can't currently do it in the way that we want to do it within the MFA, and I'm not saying we're never going to be able to do that, this is, we're learning a lot from doing this, actually to provide this, A, to Pratt alums, and B, not exclusively to Pratt alums, right, to artists in general, is something that is not only, I think, the right thing to do, when you are part, as I am, of an institution that actually is invested in, you know, obviously we don't create artists, but we are part of a system.
Absolutely.
That is about mentoring artists and educating artists. And then we have a responsibility to also do this and to continue to do it. And actually to be part of an increasing number of organizations, which is the good news, who see that there's a responsibility there.
Yeah.
So that was the reason for beginning as we have, and also speaking to Pratt about this in terms of what Pratt's values and missions are. Because a lot of the time, I think, and this is true with any organization, you know, you're looking at what your actual responsibility is, which, of course, in terms of Pratt, is with education. And so any additional anything, is it a revenue stream?
Of course.
Is it what is it doing? And because obviously institutions also have a responsibility to think about that. So I'm incredibly grateful to work for an institution that saw the value in this.
But not as a revenue
but
stream.
But not as a revenue
obviously.
Stream. Absolutely. But saw the value. And I think in terms of creating new models. So in terms of how the institution, I think, frames these things, thought leadership, again, extending support, diversity, equity, and inclusion, all of these things, which are values, community engagement, bridging from something that is the institution to external communities. So that's why we came up with, and also something that we knew we could do, because what didn't happen is nobody gave us $250,000. It was, what do we have?
They don't ever give us $250,000 to do anything.
Yeah. If you're listening out there and you would like to give Micheline, Thomas, and I $250,000 to continue Pratt
Forward. Micheline, Jane, or myself for the podcast. And if you would like to donate
$250,000,
I'll share it with you.
Yeah, we'll split it.
But pause really quickly. Mm.
The art career is thrilled to announce its sponsorship from the New York Studio School for season 4. Founded in 1964 as an intensive studio arts program with an emphasis on perception, artists learning from artists, and drawing as the most direct means of describing one's ideas or experiences, the Studio School offers an array of full-time and part-time programs that prioritize small classes and individual guidance from dedicated instructors distinguished in their fields. It is located in the heart of Greenwich Village in a National Historic Landmark building that was once home to the original Whitney Museum of American Art. The school invites you to join its free public programming, including the evening lecture series, which for more than half a century has been a cornerstone of the New York City art world and can now be experienced worldwide via live streaming. Visit nyss.org to enroll in classes, see what's on in the gallery, register for evening classes, and more. To learn more about full-time study at New York Studio School, schedule an in-person tour or a virtual meeting by emailing info@newyorkstudioschool.org. In a nutshell, basically, what is Pratt Forward? What is this wonderful program? I'm honored to be a core mentor.
So Pratt Forward is a one-month in-person program. And what it does is it connects the 10 artists who apply via an open call, just closed for this round. Five of them are Pratt alums, five of them from anywhere, emerging artists. You don't even need to have been to grad school or anything like that. And each week there are dialogue sessions, a couple of dialogue sessions a week. And we invite people like yourself, artists like Derek Adams, Jose Parla, to have discussions, intimate discussions with the cohort around things like, how do you approach that gallery?
The reality of the
art. What's the real deal when it comes to what that relationship looks like?
Yes.
And what are the kind of questions we should be asking that maybe they would prefer us not to ask, because the way the system has been set up, again, is generally on the side of the gatekeeper.
Right. So, and you are on the side of empowering the
empowering
art. I mean, our missions
artists,
are very similar, right?
Yeah.
Yes, you are on the side of empowering the artist, regardless of what that means for the other side.
Regardless, yes. And we're at a key moment, I think. I think a lot of institutions, I mean, we know that the majority of our institutions, including education, they have been set up on this kind of factory model, this 19th century kind of factory capitalist model. So all of the power is at the top, the high wages are at the top, the control is at the top, and the people at the top are not the artists. You know, they are the people who are heads of museums, et cetera, et cetera.
Damian Davis and I just had a really brilliant conversation. He was very much so talking about the same thing.
So actually, and this is partly also, and there are many different kinds of artists, but quite a lot of the time, you have artists who are working in their studios. And that's what they want to do. They want to be working in their studios. They're not thinking about small business owners, et cetera, et cetera. But they should be.
Yeah, and they someone like Micheline is a perfect
example
of this.
Yeah.
It's like she knew,
early
on that she was a small business.
Yeah.
And what she, the momentum she gained and the opportunities garnered were brilliant, you know,
absolutely,
right off the bat.
Yeah.
And she's just...
it's taking control of the situation
and
making
is.
Sure. And everything I'm going to say around this has caveats, because there are also artists that want to work in community engaged practices, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course.
There are also ways that maybe a group of artists could get together, and maybe one of them is better at the taxes and one of them is better at the PR, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what I'm not saying is every artist now has to be an entrepreneur.
No,
personally,
and some
I don't
artists
like
make art for art's sake, and that's it.
Yes.
They don't, there's
yes.
nothing outside
yeah.
of the studio. So no, I of course.
Yeah.
But the majority of artists that we work with, to some extent, would like to move their practices out into
absolutely.
Public and private spaces.
Yes, and that's also where it gets into the... because, okay, there's clarity there, right. I really want to show in galleries and sell work and et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, I know step one, small business, blah, blah, blah. I grow, I hire people, I need to know employment law, I need to have insurance. But I think where the nuance is and where the need for the kind of intimate conversation is in all of the details threaded through all of that. What exact kind of life do I want to have? You know, am I the kind of person who is, and there's only so much you can predict, but who is going to be, you know, happy with a kind of life that also means, you know, a pressure on production. I mean, if your sole income is coming from your work, you do begin to have a different relationship
with
it. Some people thrive on that. For some people, the deadline is the thing, the pressure is the thing that sparks creativity.
And then others,
for others,
they
it
drown.
Becomes a limit.
Yeah.
It becomes something that actually, so I think, but that doesn't mean you still can't want to have your work out there. It means you've got to first understand yourself.
And what it is you want.
Exactly. Knowing that that may change also.
Right.
And
of course.
What other things you want in your life.
Yeah.
So I think, especially if you know that a family is important to you, and some people will know this. Some people will always have had that as, mm-hmm. as a priority, then that does mean you need to actively factor right. that in
right.
to whatever structure or whatever community you are going to be building, because you are going to have two really equally important things going on.
Yeah.
So that, I think, may mean, I think a lot of artists who are thinking in that way defaulted to academia, because on the surface it seemed, well, I get a full-time job, I get health insurance, I get fairly decent pay, blah, blah, blah. Well, what we know is those jobs are very few and far between. Right. That may mean you're not actually living somewhere you would choose to live, because that's where the job is. Some people are fine with that. They make their peace with that. But of course, now we know a lot of that kind of teaching route leads to overwork, underpay, stress, exhaustion, and fundamentally there are big labor issues.
And the whole family's miserable as a result.
And the whole family is
kids are in therapy, marriage is falling apart, everyone's miserable as a result.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. But you know, there are other things, there sure. are other places that you can you
no,
can
it's
be
back
an
it's back to the concept of okay, what is it that you want, knowing that's going to change. But if there are specific things as an artist, a creative professional that you're like, okay, yeah. this is like Roberta Smith talking to her, I said, did you ever want children? Mm. And she said, it never even occurred to me. And then she said, I knew that I couldn't have the career I really wanted, or I'm not using the exact words, but she basically said, you know, I couldn't have had it how I wanted it and how it's turned out for her if she had children, you
it's
know?
It's so interesting that that is the exact phrase I use.
Well, I was going to ask you, I know you're a private person, but I am going to like try to ask you a couple questions just about you. Is that what it was for you?
But I use those exact words.
I love that.
It never occurred to me.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that part.
Oh, yeah. No, those exact words. It never occurred to me. That is how I respond. So it's very interesting that she should have said those
I have
exact
to tell
words.
You and Roberta, the jealousy I feel, really, I mean, I would kill to have it never, because when it does occur to you, but it's difficult or confusing or a myth, it's so layered, it's really a pain in the ass.
I'm sure it is.
There's such freedom that you don't even realize you have because you've always had it.
Mm. What I don't agree with, it's funny because I did, as I said to you earlier, I did listen to that podcast. Do not agree that also the answer is, and I'm selfish. Right?
I think we've been conditioned as women to say we're selfish.
If we don't want kids. But the other thing I would say is that in my view, I'm going to say the should word, which is problematic, but you should really want kids to have them.
Yes.
So in my view, if there's ambivalence there, don't have them.
Right.
You know, they really should be really, 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 really wanted,
right.
shouldn't they? So anyway,
also we're really, really, really overpopulated.
Well, but not some
anymore.
Areas. In Italy,
and
they're
actually,
freaking out. Yeah.
You know what's happening now in the, I mean, there are, our birth rate is dropping significantly.
Who's going to pay the taxes to pay for all of the...
I'll tell you, the next two generations, we're going to get... This conversation is going to... It's not even going to be that much of a conversation because so many people, men and women, are making choices now, which is so new. It's so new.
But that is also, I hope, that is going to force social change, because I think what's not working is the model of how you can have a family. We are living the patriarchal model, which is still, to a large extent, you need to have, you know, it's the heteronormative man, woman,
yes.
household, with one making a good income,
yes.
the other doing the majority of the childcare.
So
we need to look at all of
the
that.
whole situation.
This is why I love the conversations.
I love this conversation
around non-binary,
yes.
gender fluidity, because I think it's not. So you know, back to my choices. I certainly I didn't feel pressure from my family, thank goodness. I think they thought, hope she doesn't have children. Don't think she'd be able to.
You're like, I don't want to. Like, oh, okay. Yeah.
But I think it also in relation to partners, having a partner, yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah.
We are still, it is still the tyranny of coupledom, right? I really think it is. And so this idea, can't we just all be individuals and it not be why not this or why are you not doing that or the big question marks? We still seem to be...
But that's the patriarchy.
Yes, exactly.
That's exactly what it is. It has nothing to do with anything other than that, because even when I was in a same-sex relationship, okay, and I'm with a man now. I was with women for 10 years before. Even then, this concept of being in a relationship, of being a couple. No. We're not together because I wanted to go out to dinner alone tonight, right? Mm-hmm. Or no, I'm on this vacation. No, we're fine. I just wanted to go on this vacation on my own, you know? It's a concept that, and for someone who grew up in, you know, suburban USA, the majority of, you know, the people that I grew up with are very much in heteronormative white picket fence relationships with children. And so I don't know. It's one of my favorite things about talking to creatives, because this is such a conversation, you know, and this is something that needs to change just as much as our dialogue in the art world, you know?
Yeah, and I think if you think about what motivates, well, it's not even what motivates an artist. You know, when I think about that fundamental question, why are you an artist? I think for me, there is that little bit of separation. There's this little bit of feeling like slightly outside of things and observing them, whether that be looking at a cup on a table and observing that it's not just a cup, right? It's material, it's surface, and those are the things that you learn by looking. And actually you learn by drawing, because drawing is really more about teaching you to look than it is teaching you to draw. But I think that the other component of that is that what an artist does is then kind of extract and re-present. So you can see that thing outside of its enmeshed context. Now, what we need to do is do that with society. Because this is why I love, you know, I love all of these amazing women who have done work on looking at gender, because a lot of it is drawing our attention, reminding us the extent to which we are trained to perform roles, and they become inextricable from how we see ourselves. So again, this notion of extraction and re-presentation. The famous example, of course, being Duchamp and the bottle rack. Nobody sees it. Nobody sees it. Why? Because it has a function and it's within a context. The minute you take the function away, hasn't got any bottles on it, and it's not in a bar, it's in a gallery, people see it as shape, texture, form, sculpture. So if we did that with the idea of woman, the idea of man, and we look at the fact that still in whatever it is, 2023, if a man wears a skirt, immediately now people would think, oh, that person's trans or that person's. It is still kind of unacceptable for just a cis man to wear a skirt.
Right. Why does it have to be, oh, they're trans?
How the hell did that happen? Yeah. When you look at 16th century Europe and people are wearing, you know, doublet and hose and wigs.
How the fuck did that happen?
So question everything, question everything, question everything. And reaffirm, first try to slough off all of that received, I was going to say wisdom, but it isn't wisdom. All of that meshedness,
Yeah.
You know, to try and actually figure out if none of that, who would you be? What would you be doing?
Here's the thing. It almost, in this conversation, we're almost romanticizing being able to do this. You and I are women that are trying our best to do that. It's hard to be a trailblazer, right? Mm. Like, it's not, this is, you know, even I remember I came out as queer in high school and I'm 43. So it was really in Greenwich, Connecticut. Okay. So it was really at the beginning, wasn't at the beginning of anything, but this wasn't happening a lot, right? When I was, and then I was dating a trans man a couple years ago, and I was just, I found myself, I was laughing about this with Damian Davis the other day, like, don't you know what we did for you? Because like everything felt so much easier. It's hard when you're part of the generation that is transitioning, changing things, making those moves. You know, it's messy and you falter and you kind of go, I find myself returning to a patriarchal model several times a day where I have to catch myself, right? Hopefully a couple generations from now, you know, we will have made it a little easier.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that it is also not great for a lot of men. Because I think, I think the problem with all of this sometimes is it starts to pit groups against each other.
I'm so glad you said that.
Not working for any of us.
I'm so glad you said that.
And capitalism is not working for any other than the billionaires. It's not working. People are anxious. People are unhappy. It's not working. And that doesn't mean communism, right? Because that was always the, well, capitalism is good because if not communism,
I know
I
my
think
father
might
would
be
like,
some other
what
options.
Are you a communist?
I'm there like, might be other options.
No, there are, and you know it's tricky too because I'm someone I take advantage of capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. Like I work with some of the wealthiest people in the world as an art advisor. I don't want that to go anywhere.
Well,
you know, and that is so, that's just an honest statement, you know?
This came up yesterday in this workshop we did. I think one of the graduate students said, have you ever sold work or has anybody whose values you don't agree with ever wanted to buy your work? And so it did open up that whole conversation.
Well, what was the, I mean, let me ask you. If someone whose values don't, and I'm not saying that my values don't align with my clients. Mm. I love all of my clients and I don't work with people that I genuinely don't
like.
Well,
partly I think the difficulty partly is how do you know? How do you know no? So, you know, somebody comes along. I mean, am I going to Google that person and you know, find out exactly what their values are?
Well, I'm not. I'm taking the money.
Right.
That's
right.
The truth, Jane, right? That isn't a lot of people. I mean, and you can judge me, you can whatever, but I am a firm believer and I cannot make the changes that I want to see in the world if I am poor. For me.
Yeah.
I can't.
But
I need
back,
money to
I
do
think,
that.
Again, I mean, this kind of conversation that we're having now, which will be available to everybody, partly back to Pratt Forward, it's those kinds of conversations. I think we look at now, obviously there's a lot of activism around who's on the board of the museum and all of this stuff. I mean, you only have to look at the named institutions we have in New York, and a lot of them are from robber baron wealth. I mean, we talk about greenwashing, we talk about, you know, we know that the art world, because it's not regulated financially, we know that it is a money laundering machine. We know that, but there is resistance. Mm-hmm. There is absolute resistance from many, many, many parts to keep the status quo. Because, in fact, that is sort of the basis of of the economy of the existing art world, which, and again, when I say art world, I really, really just want to acknowledge that there are many. Some, and this is back to what does an individual artist do, and what I say is you have to make your own decisions, mm-hmm. you have to own those decisions, and you have to make peace with them. Mm-hmm. And also you have to know where you could be effective. So when when I was younger and I was at art school, I was very involved in the student union. And it was the time, Thatcher's Britain, when they were rationalizing everything. So they were going towards, you could say, an even more kind of colonial structure, hierarchical mm-hmm. structure. For a long time, I was just out there adjuncting. And it always seemed frustrating and weird and discombobulating to me how, while I was very socially and politically aware and active, none of that was in my work. And it made me question, ooh. You know, I was, why? And I would try, and then it would be, that's so phony, or that's so not what I want to do. So I had to kind of ask myself, not so much, what work do I want to make? Because creativity doesn't work like that.
What choices? But
how? Why is it that I need to do this thing? Yeah. And ultimately, I thought I need to do it because I need time alone to process. I mean, not even that was it. I need time alone. So now I could unpack why. For me, I think I'm one of these people that I can be very, 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 very social, and then I'm exhausted.
Well, so you're an introverted extrovert.
Sounds like.
That's what you are. That's what I am.
Yeah. Yeah. So then I want to just, and there's a kind of meditative side to making work, especially the kind of work I make. I love certain processes. So it is a kind of, I mean, I joke and I say it's a mental health thing, but maybe that's not such a joke. It's I need to do it. And so actually, that is where, to use this problematic word, authenticity. That's where, for me, the authenticity lies. The authenticity in the work lies with going with that. Going with that, owning that, and actually saying, it's okay. It's okay to, you know, you have to be able to just do what you need to do.
And oftentimes that will produce the most successful work for you anyway.
Irrespective of, right? And then you think, well, what other skills do I have? What other things, you know, am I able to do? And how can they be impactful? So for me, ultimately, it took a while, but ultimately education. And not just education as in the engagement with individual students in the classroom around art and around art making, which I also think is philosophy. I think really that's a lot of what happens in art making. But in terms of all of these things, institutions, structures, conditions, questioning. So I think with Pratt Forward, it's also, you know, stretching the institution a little bit, and saying, you know, generosity is very important now. And it's very important that we take responsibility for being part of, our part of building an ecosystem.
Right.
And building an ecosystem that we know fundamentally does not center artists. What can we do to kind of nudge that a little bit? I think of the role of an artist in society being somewhat the kind of the irritant, the joker, the and of course we look at many, many cultures, and there are always people, the how the artist or the maker or the ritual provider, it's always been there. Yeah. People have always made things. And again, I come back to, for me, and this just helps me as language, it may not apply to everybody, this idea of having this little kind of removal, this critical distance from everything.
As someone extremely passionate about mental health, seeing a therapist is essential to my quality of life. We'd like to take this moment to announce how thrilled we are to partner with the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp. If you think you might be feeling anxious, depressed, or even just overwhelmed, being alone with your thoughts can be an isolating feeling. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't even have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. It's that easy. Join the 2 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. And just for the Art Career podcast listeners, we will offer 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/TAC. That's better, BETTER, help, HELP.com/TAC. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring the Art Career podcast.
So yeah, this is hard because Jane and I are, I can call us friends at this point. I consider you a friend, Jane. And we could really sit here for a very long time talking about a million different things. And you, I hate the term, you wear so many hats, but you do. I mean, you really, you are prolific in your approach to success and how your career trajectory has.
You see, you've just said two words that I could I could push back on.
Tell me, tell me, push back.
One is success and one is career trajectory. Okay. Because I just don't think about it like that at all. Because of course the other question we always propose to again artists who are finding their way is you really have to think about what that would look like to you.
To you.
And so this is also where I think that the choices that I have made, what I have not done is become a small business and focus on that and have not have another job, et cetera, et cetera.
So what have
you done? Because that would not
suit
That would not suit me.
That isn't success to you.
Exactly, because A, I don't want anybody else in my studio. And I think at a certain point, you kind of need to scale.
Yeah.
If you are literally going to be making a living and sustain making a living from your work, unless magically, because I do think there's a certain kind of thing we don't know about this, and unless for some reason you're making two paintings a year,
no,
and they're each
selling
for hundreds
of
thousands of dollars.
Process.
Yeah. So for me, you know, what I know about myself is I just love being in there by myself, listening to music, getting lost in the process. I enjoy the hell out of that. And I also really value not needing to sell anything. So I pay my bills some other way. I never think about, oh, maybe I should make a couple of these smaller or never think about it.
You don't
that.
Have to.
So it's really, I suppose it's the one large area of my life when it is absolutely on my terms.
Oh, I love that,
all
Jane.
So.
Well, you've created a system for your success in which you can have that be yours and yours only.
Yes. I mean, that for me, that it feels good. Again, it's back to, I need that. I need that space. And I think, meanwhile, I love my job.
Yeah.
I love it. How amazing to spend so much time with people who have found art, who are asking all of those questions, who are experimenting.
It never gets old.
It's amazing. Yeah. And my colleagues, that the faculty are extraordinary and they are all so different and doing different things. And then, of course, I meet people like you and Micheline, and then we're able to do something.
Yes.
That
yes.
is free.
Yes.
Free, free, free.
Yes.
That helps, we hope. Now, scale always comes into the equation in terms of these things because, and Micheline and I are both very much on the same page. We are not going to scale this. This is not, oh, we're only doing 10 now because that's all we can do.
No, this is going to remain.
In 10 years' time, we want to do 100. The way we've thought about scale is in terms of, oh, wouldn't it be great if those 10 artists who have done Pratt Forward go to wherever they are. So we had two, for example, from Detroit last time, and they start something like Pratt Forward there. And where we can still help is because obviously Mickey knows people who have a platform in Detroit, right? So then we're still, let's say they wanted to do that, then it's, oh, well, you should meet so-and-so in Detroit because we know,
and
again,
use our system that we put together.
Blah, blah, blah. Right. And that's partly also why we always intended, we never intended for there to be a specific location. So last year it was at New Lab in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. That presented a whole series of opportunities because it's largely technology. That was awesome. So there were facilities, blah, 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 connecting with other communities. This time it's Silver Art Projects, which is amazing, and
World Trade Center. So cool.
The other idea is how can we share ideas about new models? And how can we lend our, and obviously we know that you know there is leverage in
branding.
Well,
how can we help each other?
Yeah.
I think
And do it in, I keep using this word rhizomic, you know, do it in that rhizomic kind of way.
And then it's not opportunistic, right?
Yeah. Like, well, and I'm always very wary of, okay, what's your angle?
But I sometimes always have an angle. Yeah. That doesn't mean I don't genuinely care and want to help you as much as I want you to help me.
I know.
So
I know.
That's just honest, right?
Yeah, and like, that's true.
Yeah, you have to have an angle to be super successful, whatever that means.
Yes. I don't know why I have such a problem with it, with these terms. Maybe I'm just in denial.
Well, I have
about
to tell you
it.
Something. Every fucking time I say career trajectory, I want to kill myself.
Why are we adopting the language of a system that we know isn't working?
I don't know. You know. I don't know.
Language
matters.
So why are we not thinking of other? Which we do in other
areas.
Because
that is a power word.
To me, it's a cringe word.
No,
because it centers this idea of it. To me, it's just completely connected with neoliberal capitalism. That's where the word comes from. It's anyway.
All right, wait, hold on a second, Jane. You just had a solo exhibition that came. It was extended through October 28th, and it just came down. It just came down. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this really quickly because blah, 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 blah. We have all these things and you just had a solo exhibition right?
Yes.
So yeah.
Yeah. I've been working with Spencer Brownstone. Oh my gosh. I had my first solo show with them. I think it was it wasn't a solo show. It was one of those. I was in one room and somebody was in another room in 2001. So I've been working with that gallery for over 20 years. Which is a gift because I think it would be very difficult for any artist to make work for a considerable amount of time, not knowing if it's going to be out there in the world. So just knowing that, but also again, kind of on my own terms, there's no pressure. Oh, it's 2 years. You need to do another show. 2 years. You need to do another show. It's if I'm ready, I say to them, I think I might be ready. Yeah.
They're supportive of that.
They're great. So, yes. And this work, the show I had prior to this one was in 2020. It opened 2 weeks before lockdown.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I was literally just at the point where I was kind of introducing a bit of a shift from previous work. Previous work, a lot of the time, was these large-scale structures that were responded to site, were made of components, were hand cut and folded paper with a architectural wooden scaffold. And, you know, I reached a point at which I thought, I cannot bloody cut one more piece of paper.
I just
and I think this is a lot of the time we mystify the creative process and I mean, it is very mysterious, a lot of it, thank goodness.
No, but that's some, I see what you're saying.
There are also some fundamental things, which is, I just don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah, like
I don't
want to
do this anymore. And how can I, what the hell then? What am I going to do? And so there were a few years of real pain I mean, it can be bloody painful searching around. And I'm sure this will resonate with a lot of students, because I think that's also what the good thing about getting older is, you do know in the back of your head, you do know, yeah, you have been here before. Mm-hmm. Keep going. You will get through it. But if it's the first time you've been through it, you don't know that.
It's like your first heartbreak.
Yeah, you just have to keep, and my friend, good friend, Ellen Driscoll, I remember when I was in the midst of this, and I can't even go into my studio. Literally couldn't go into my studio because it just made me feel awful. Because I just didn't know, I felt like I'd lost something.
You didn't feel like you had a hole.
It was awful.
Yeah.
And she just said, you know, Jane, you got to keep showing up. You got to keep showing up.
Such good advice.
And I was like,
it's so simple, but so profound, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to keep showing up.
And that's when you really get into the kind of parallel that what happens in the studio is also helps in terms of how you navigate your life.
Of course.
You've got to just keep showing up.
Yeah, well, that's what you said that to me. I'm not a studio artist. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah. It is, there's no way around it. You got to go through it. We know all these things. These things are cliches.
My father's best advice he ever gave me, the only cure for despair is action.
Yeah.
And it's so true.
But then it's a question of what do you mean by action?
Right. Well, because showing up.
Showing up.
Showing up.
Doing something.
Doing something.
Yeah, not just staying in
that
bed.
That action doesn't have to. Yeah.
So that, I carried on and carried on. And then the most weird things happen. And this is absolutely true. And I don't know, I still don't know how it happened. I just kept hearing these two words, sewing machine. And I have never stitched anything. I'm not a sewer.
Don't strike me
a sewer. I did theater right. set and costume design.
I know,
design.
I just learned
did
that
I ever
about you.
Design a costume? No, I didn't.
No, it was the design.
I just wanted to throw paint around on things. So I ignored it. So that's a stupid idea. Sewing machine. And it was actually industrial sewing machine. And I thought, I went through, I do tend to be a kind of worst case scenario thinker, which can be useful sometimes, but I went through this, oh yeah, and then I'm going to buy the sewing machine and then it's going to be sitting there in my
mocking
home.
You.
Yeah, saying, well, that was another stupid idea, right. Wasn't it? So I went to my good friend, Lee Borison, who has industrial sewing machines. And I said, Lee, can I just bring a few things over? And I just want to see, you know, blah, blah. So he said, yes. And I'm sitting there and he's showing me how to do it. And I put the thing there and I hit the pedal and it goes, zoom, and that was it. I could do this forever.
So you were.
I drew this.
You were like, you were like,
I'm
sewing machine.
I am. In.
Right, it made sense.
So I got one from Craigslist, and then I had to figure out how to use it, and then it broke down, and then I had to figure out how to fix it. And I do love mechanical things.
But you knew as soon as you felt that was
it processed. Like I knew when I first did a weld. Wow, this feels great. Like I did when I first, you know, dipped a ink pen in a pot of ink and drew a line on a piece of beautiful rag paper, and
you saw
that line go, you know, that, God, I could just do this forever. Like I did when I cut a piece of paper with, you know, there's something about that action, and I could do this. And so it really is about that, repeating, finding a way to continue to be able to do that. And then, of course, COVID hit. So the first show was those first kind of experiments with literally deconstructing things, stitching them on canvas, and of course a language emerges. Of course it does. You keep going, you really try not to think at all. You know, the for me, it shut off that editor, that cognitive part of the brain in the studio. And you know, I kind of resist then going back into the studio to look at what's just happened, because I think there's another part of the process that happens in a way. You've got to kind of gestate. I mean, this for me anyway is how I kind of think through it. And so then you kind of go back and you sort of look and think, oh my God, it's going to be wah, wah, wah. And sometimes it is. That's fine, right? You have to talk yourself through that, because as we always say, failure is part of the process. Doubt is part of faith. And then you do something again. And the wonderful thing, I think, with all of the processes that I've ever used is they're very undoable. So the many, many times I've had some large thing, usually I work on the floor because it's just, I like to walk around it. I don't like things to have a fixed orientation. And so sometimes I've been fighting with something and trying to make it work and battling with it. And then you get to that point of just, I'm just going to cut the fucking thing in half. I'm going to just do some radical, it's the kind of throwing the spanner in the works. I need to do something big.
Yes.
I need to do something destructive. I really need to make that gesture and to open up the new set of possibilities.
I love that.
And that's the part of the process that I really love. Because that's also when you start surprising yourself. It's, this needs some kind of radical other thing.
This whole conversation is like a metaphor for life too, right?
Yeah,
the studio practice as metaphor for life,
Absolutely.
Breaking that open, destructiveness, and then reemerging into, okay, what is this now? And psychology. Yeah.
Looking
changes.
At the backside of the thing. I mean, the very interesting thing is so much of the time, and this is back to this, and I remember hearing this in the podcast with Roberta, this idea of the so-called outsider artist, that sometimes that work is people, you so connect with that work because it's coming from an individual that for whatever reason has not been fully enmeshed,
right?
So there isn't, and a lot of the time with students, you can see, you go into the studio and you can see the work and then you can see the art that they have been trying to make, the capital A art. And I can see, we all do it because it's very difficult not to be meshed, but that's what you're trying to get to. You're trying to get beyond, you're trying to strip off all of the stuff that's been loaded on you. And that's why making art can be literally so painful, because when you do fail, whatever that means, you have something, you've externalized something, nobody has asked you to do it, there it is, and it's looking at you and it's going, look, I'm crap, you made me. I mean, it really can be. And if you're in one of those modes where that keeps happening,
how do you not shut down?
Especially when for you, this is your rock. Well, forget livelihood.
Rock.
This is your
stability.
This is who you are. So you get into all of these identity. So that's why you really, really have to develop. And when we talk about the discipline of the practice all the time, the kind of the work, the self-discipline, to really know when you are going into that place and to reframe it's how it works. So rather than when that thing does that, or you made me when I'm crap, it's think of it, and there are many other ways to think about it. We think about it sometimes in terms of data. Well, for a scientist, I'm going to do this experiment. It failed, but it's given me more data to work with. So of course, it's important.
Data.
It's necessary.
I like that.
It has to. So the problem is, I think, for me or for most artists, is how do we negotiate the relationship between the work without it becoming something that feels like a relationship that's going wrong, right? Because we do, or I do, it does start to feel like that, or it's so much part of my identity that it's. If it's going wrong, it's failed, it's undermining my sense of who I am because it's not working. It's like, stop it. No. Reframe it. Put it in the sense of actually, you are now at that part of the process where it is still giving you something to work
with. And knowing
with.
That is just as important as the opposite of that.
The work that does not
go well. I wasn't
going to
say success, right? But the opposite of that. It's just because you're in that process of data, of garnering that data.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I could sit here with you for hours. And my favorite conversations I always have, I'm like, oh, I'll just bring them back in a couple seasons, right? Because I intend to have this podcast and I would love to continue this conversation with you. And I think it's going to be so beneficial we're just talking about, the audience of the podcast. Mm. It's not just for artists, right? Like our yes. as metaphor mm-hmm. studio practices, metaphor for life. Mm-hmm. It's so, you just gave us so much gold. And thank you for inviting us into your home as well.
Well, you're very, very welcome. And thank you, because I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Thank you, Jean.
All right, thanks, lovely.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Art Career. If you get value from this podcast, please consider helping me make more of these episodes by becoming an Art Career Premium member at theartcareer.supercast.com. That's theartcareer.supercast.com. SUPERCAST.com. And please don't forget to rate and review. Every rating counts. Thanks so much.